From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our guest is Spike Carlson. Spike is a creature of adventure and curiosity. He takes a simple walk around the block and explores every marvel of sanitation, engineering, wildlife, electricity, basically everything that make our lives run smoothly, or even just make our lives run. And, you know, we have ceased to notice some of these things or even appreciate them, from manhole covers and sewer systems to electricity and the power grid to why we get better gas mileage on concrete versus pavement. Carlson is an interesting storyteller, historian, and he has traveled to all corners of the earth to explore some of these topics. His new book is A Walk Around the Block. Spike Carlson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, it's a pleasure being here.
Your book is so inspiring in so many ways. A Walk Around the Block. Stoplight secrets, mischievous squirrels, manhole mysteries, and other stuff you see every day and know nothing about. And this is our thing, Spike. I think that as adults, most of us lose our childlike curiosity. And you are someone who has not only invigorated your childlike curiosity, but you've made it your own, and now you've written a book about it.
Yeah, you know, I realized I'd read books on climbing Mount Everest and going down the Amazon and traveling to the moon, and I'd written books about Stradivari violins and catapults, but I really knew nothing about the world right outside, you know, my front door. And it's a world full of wonder and intrigue, and so I wrote a book about it.
That's so great. So I really love that you start with talking about the front porch, and because we know that we can now, because most of our houses, I would say 99% of our houses, no longer have the front porch, and this is one of the reasons, including the automobile culture, that we do, oftentimes do not know our neighbors. And you talk about how it used to be where the backyard was kind of a yucky place, drudgery, you called it, and the front porch was where you could go to relax.
Yeah, I mean, the backyard had your outhouse and your chickens and your wood pile. And so the front porch at one point was kind of, you know, Facebook and newspaper and radio and social center all rolled into one. And it's making a resurgence today. About two-thirds of the houses being built have a front porch. And not only does it add curb appeal, of course, but they found that, you know, porches, because you're kind of keeping an eye on neighbors and one another, they increase safety, and you get to know people. And in this day and age of COVID-19, they're part public, they're part private, they're an ideal way to kind of engage with people safely. You know, you usually don't walk up to someone on the street and just start chatting, but on the porch is kind of a social lubricant. It's kind of like walking the dog. You know, you have something to talk about, you're outside. So the front porch is making a resurgence.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Spike Carlson. He has just written A Walk Around the Block, Stoplight Secrets, Mischievous Squirrels, Manhole Mysteries, and Other Stuff You See Every Day and Know Nothing About. Spike, we enjoyed the book, and there was one piece of the book that really caught my attention, and that was when you were talking about alleys. And that's, of course, a big distinction between Boston, where I'm from, and New York City. New York City, even years ago, not to have alleys, as you describe in the book. And Boston has alleys, and the alley is a really important part of the fabric of the city, where in the front of these brownstones, it's impossible to park, but you have a front door, and it's really nice. But in the back of the alley, you have access to back of your place, you have a place to park your car, you bump into neighbors, you can have your trash taken out. And I just enjoyed that particular piece of your book. Oh, I wanted to mention that when people would drive in to their alley in Boston and they had a deeded parking spot, they would install these lights that would go on when the car broke, you know, the barrier there, and the light would go on automatically. If you got up at like 2 or 3 in the morning to get a drink of water or something, you would see lights flashing, but there were no cars. It was the size of these rats that were setting off the lights in our alley. And it was like a, like little explosions of light.
You know, with, again, you know, with the pandemic, alleys have now turned into dining areas. I'm in the little river town of Stillwater, Minnesota, and I'd say 4 or 5 restaurants that never had outside dining before have taken over the alley space, you know, with the blessings of the local government, and they've become restaurants. And, you know, alleys, like you say, they're kind of social places. And also, if we start rethinking about alleys, what a great place for accessory buildings or mother-in-law apartments. And my consultant on this was a guy who gives alley tours, and people are just fascinated by the potential. You can have gallery showings and movie showings, and it's just kind of a matter of rethinking the alley.
Right, exactly. And I also wanted to ask you about one of your chapters, Telephone Wires and Waves. And I don't know if you can go through this with us quickly, but if you could take us through how long it would take for some gossip from New York City, maybe on Justin Bieber's bad behavior, to be able to reach you 1,000 miles away, looking at the various technologies over the years.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a funny little section, but it's indicative of the approach I took with this book. I tried to get across good information, yet keep it entertaining. And so, you know, that particular event you're talking about with Justin Bieber, you know, if that had to travel by foot messenger, which was the fastest way of getting information across at one point, that would have taken, you know, 11 days. And then you get up to signal telegraphy with, you know, smoke signals and flags. That would have taken a day and a half. And messenger pigeon, that still would have taken a day and 10 hours. But with the cell phone, it takes 0.0053 seconds for information to travel. And so I just kind of traced the history of communication, and I tried to pick a somewhat humorous event for an example.
That's fascinating.
Spike, as you take a walk around the block or down the street, what are the first things that you notice? And you must have had to sharpen your own noticing skills, I guess, as you were trying to create fodder for this book. I'm just wondering, you know, many of us walk, many of us don't walk, but as we do, there's so many things we just take for granted. And I think that's probably one of the things that you said, hey, I'm not going to take anything for granted. I'm going to question everything. But how did you do it?
Well, you know, I'm naturally curious person. And so let's just take a walk around the block. And the concrete you're walking on has a fascinating history. It's the most used material on the planet right now. It's created about 10 billion tons of it a year. And so that's enough for 3,000 pounds for every man, woman, and child on the planet. And, you know, the Romans concocted the formula for it and figured out how to do it, you know, 200 and 300 AD. And then the formula got lost for 900 years. And there was no concrete construction, or very little concrete construction, for about 900 years. And then the formula was rediscovered in a Swiss monastery in 1400 or 1500 AD. And it's those types of stories that I just find so fascinating. It combines history with science, with a sense of wonder. And I just love that kind of thing.
So if we're looking at treatments for roads, for example, I've often wondered, you know, when is it that you use concrete versus asphalt? And then, you know, in the east of this country, there are still some roads with bricks, and you go further east to Europe, cobblestones. And What is the evolution of how we decide to treat something that we drive on every single day and hardly ever think about?
That's a great question. You know, originally roads were just dirt. And then as they started finding hard surfaces, they tried wood, and that turned out that it was slippery. And, you know, stone, of course, wore very well, but it was so noisy that shop owners would complain they couldn't even hear their customers talking, and bricks were bumpy. And so a lot of different things were experimented with. And then finally, this substance called asphalt or tarmacadan came around. And today, about 95% of our roads are asphalt. And when we look at them, we go, oh, that's a lot of black asphalt, but really about 90 or 95% of that surface is stone and aggregate and that type of thing. So people talk about it as asphalt concrete. And there's, you know, new asphalts being developed now that'll wear longer and work harder. So like so many other things, this is kind of part of an evolution that's ongoing.
Your observations of these various things is fascinating. But the other thing that came out of the book that I really enjoyed were the characters that you bumped into and that you spoke about. One of those characters, Heather Montgomery, we spoke to yesterday about Who Gives a Poop, you know, the surprising science from one end to the other. And you did a complete chapter on roadkill, which she is enthusiastic about. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how, you know, one thing will lead to another. And sorry about that. And I was doing research on roadkill, and I was heading down to Marlinton, West Virginia, to visit the roadkill cook-off, their annual roadkill cook-off. And when I was talking with the organizers, I just off the cuff said, you know, if you need a judge, if someone bows out, just let me know. And someone did bow out, and I was one of the judges. But like Heather, I'm sure Heather talked about, there's a serious side to roadkill. And, you know, there's about over 1 million large animals killed a year by vehicles. And there's also at least 200 people a year die in similar collisions. And like she may be covered, there's things we can do to prevent that. You know, the time of day where we're traveling makes a large impact. There's areas where near food sources or dumps where animals are more likely to cross. And Heather was just fascinating to talk to. While we were talking, she broke out, you know, skeletons of a fox. And she's a teacher and brings these things around to classrooms. And when you see the shoulder structure of a fox or the, you know, the skeleton of a fox, you realize, well, you know, that's kind of how I'm put together too. And so Heather was an absolute gem to work with. And one of the reasons, as a writer, it's so fun to do things like this.
Yeah, absolutely. As you were doing your research, because the research is extensive and all the observations that you made and all the traveling, what most surprised you about putting this book together?
You know, in retrospect, I have to say that we talk so much about essential workers, healthcare workers and teachers, and they indeed are essential workers. But as I walk through power plants, recycling centers, you know, trash disposal, mail carriers, electrical plants, all these people are so essential to keeping, you know, our society moving and keeping us comfortable. And they're not recognized that often. And this book, I think, recognizes and celebrates these people as people. I try to celebrate their stories. And so that was really one of the surprising things. Another thing was, there's so much focus on national politics. And again, that's, you know, correct, but there's so many things we can do also on a local level. If we don't like healthcare policies, we can just walk more and bike more. And there's huge benefits to doing those types of things. And there's lots of things we can do on a local level, you know, to take care of the environment. So I think that was another thing that stuck with me, was how many things we can do on a local and neighborhood basis.
Mm, I like that. If you're just joining us, our guest is Spike Carlson. He has written a book called A Walk Around the Block. It's interesting that you talk about, well, not only essential workers, but the places that they work. And, you know, here in Park City, it's a small town. And years ago, out at the outskirts of town was the recycle center and a substation, a power station. Well, now, as town has built up around it, that substation is literally right in the middle of town. And I would imagine that you saw a lot of that sort of thing. And I think, you know, from time to time, there's conversation about, well, it needs to get moved somewhere else, or at least the power lines should be buried because they're unsightly. And, you know, it would help as development occurs and redevelopment if the power lines were buried. It's very costly to do that. And I would argue that, I don't know, more than half of the people couldn't tell you where the power lines are. Again, because we just accept these things, their existence, without really noticing them. And I just thought I would ask you about that.
Yeah, I mean, your question leads me to one guy I was interviewing in the recycling world, and he was at a community meeting where they were discussing putting in a recycling center. And the woman was protesting, and he said, well, where does your garbage and recycling go? And she responded, to the curb. And that was, you know, that was her answer. So we really don't think that much about the things that we can't see. But with electricity, it's much more expensive to bury the lines, and it takes much more time to repair them if they are damaged. Of course, we look at things happening out in California and you go, well, you know, maybe that's money well spent. But it's just like with everything, there are trade-offs between convenience and budget and repair and all those types of things. I found even telephone poles to be weirdly fascinating. There's a hierarchy to them, and you know, the very lowest level is called the yard sale zone, where people pack up their yard sale signs. But then as you go up a little higher, you have the low voltage and communication area, and then there's a 4-foot gap, and you get to the kind of household current. And then when you get to the very top, you get to the high transmission lines. And, you know, so there's a hierarchy to even telephone poles. So, you know, and one thing I found about telephone poles that's weirdly fascinating is most of them have a birthmark. And that birthmark is located at about eye level, and it'll give you the date where the pole was planted and where it was made and what kind of wood it was. And if that birthmark isn't at eye level, if it's way above your head, the pole probably wasn't planted deep enough. And if it's way low, it was probably buried too deep, because that birthmark is put at the factory at the level it should be. So, you know, even a telephone pole can be fascinating.
That's right. And also, I'm wondering in your travels how often you encountered power poles that were turned into art and or power boxes. That's something that we have undertaken, the power boxes along the sides of the road. They have been decorated with art. And I think that, obviously it draws your eye to it and it makes you aware of where these things are. And then it turns something that is not so beautiful into something that fits into the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, why not make your walk around the block more interesting with things like that? And I spent an afternoon with a graffiti artist in Paris, and we did some graffiti. And, you know, it's a chance for people to express themselves and get a message out there. And you know, most people appreciate it. So I think anything we can do to make your walk around the block more interesting is a good thing.
You know, Spike, it wasn't very long ago when we were dumping all of our sewage into the sea. You talk about in Los Angeles, that 7-mile pipe, and of course what New York City was doing. And that just really wasn't very long ago. What are we doing today that will seem absolutely archaic 50 years from now, 75 years from now?
Good question. There are forever chemicals out there now that just cannot be filtered out of the water. And so I think we're going to look back and look at those and realize we should have been more, you know, proactive in that. You're so right about sewage. I mean, and I'm near the Mississippi River. And in 1926, the U.S. Bureau of Fish did a survey of the river 40 miles below the Twin Cities, and they found 3 living fish. People just used to dump raw sewage into the rivers. And so we've really come a long way. And, there are things we should be careful about, you know, what we dump in. Surely prescription pills, but even things like kitty litter and oils and grease and dead goldfish have an impact. We have to realize that there's people downstream from us that deal with the stuff we throw in there. And I think that's an important thing to realize.
And also in your book, Spike, you talk, well, let me just set this up first. We have some restrictions in this town in Park City for plastic bags. And I continue to hear from people push back saying, oh, this whole plastic bag ban is crazy. You know, we should be able to have them. And maybe you can spend a couple minutes and talk about the working life of a plastic bag and also how we compare to a country such as Denmark.
Yeah, that's a great question. I tried to be, you know, politically neutral and just get, you know, the science out there. And it turns out that to create a plastic bag takes about 1 thimble of petroleum. And to create a paper bag, it's probably the equivalent of about 4 thimbles. And this is when you take into account transportation and harvesting and all that. And a cotton bag takes 173 thimbles of petroleum to make. And part of that is because, you know, cotton is so pesticide and irrigation intensive. And so every day we really do have to make decisions as to which way to go. If you recycle your paper bags and, you know, reuse your cotton bag 174 times, you know, you're ahead of the game. But those are the types of things we can think about. The useful life of a single-use bag is usually about 12 minutes. And it can take up to 100 years for one of those to decompose. And we're just so used to using those in the U.S. The world uses about 5 trillion single-use bags a day. If you go to some countries, I believe it's like Denmark, they'll use 4 a year. And in the U.S., that's per person. And in the U.S., I think the number is closer to 600 or 700. And so that's, I try to take a more general look at things and let people make their own decisions based on that.
Well, that's a great explanation, Spike. And, you know, we could probably talk about plastic bags versus cotton bags all day, but we're running out of time. And I wanted to get a chance to ask you about pigeons. It turns out that the acid content of pigeon poo can deteriorate stone exteriors and paint. And for a high-rise building, you say it can cost north of $100,000 to have pigeon control. You spend some time with a gentleman, Dr. Phil Nelson, who happens to own 240 pigeons. Tell us about your pigeon experience.
Well, it's so hard to interview a pigeon. And yeah. So I did what was second best and interviewed Phil, who'd worked with pigeons for about 40 years. And they do have their downside. People of course call them, rats with wings and things like that. But to spend time with these guys, you know, they call them the poor man's racehorse. And they're just so excited about pigeons. they can find their way home from, there's regularly 100 mile races. And the way they, you know, find their way home is they have, you know, keen eyesight and hearing and smelling. And then they have sensitivity to gravitational and magnetic forces that we as humans don't have. And so just to spend time with these people and see how passionate they are. I mean, pigeons have been taught to play ping pong and to guide missiles during World War II. In wartime, there's a medal given out for animal bravery, and horses have gotten the award 3 times and dogs 18 times, and pigeons have gotten the award 32 times. And so they're fascinating animals, and there is a downside. But for the most part, you know, for decades, centuries, they were the fastest form of communication. And again, fascinating animals and some really fascinating stories when you get to spend 3 days with a pigeon racer.
Well, we don't have a lot of pigeons here in Park City, but we do have a lot of magpies, which I'm sure is a whole other story that you can tell us about sometime. The book is A Walk Around the Block, Stoplight Secrets, Mischievous Squirrels, Manhole Mysteries, and other stuff you see every day and know nothing about. And our guest is Spike Carlson. Spike, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and what a great book you've written. Thank you so much.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Spike.
Take care.
Again, Spike Carlson and Walk Around the Block. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.